The next case this morning is case number 59583, Richard Alter v. Resort Properties of America. Good morning, Mr. Morris, Mr. Kent.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justice Douglas, Justice Cherry, and of course Justice Hardesty. Thank you for taking the time to entertain this argument. This is our second time before you in this particular case, coming upon 10 years since it started. And when I was preparing for this argument yesterday, I took a look at what I had not considered before, the website, your website, and I see that there was a synopsis for this case on the website. As I read through that and thought about the record which I was then reviewing, it occurred to me, and I ask you to consider this, that the synopsis is incomplete in some respects, and it omits some material facts. The suggestion from the synopsis is that this litigation started as a consequence of David Atwell sending Richard Alter some information, which then created or caused a meeting in Las Vegas between the two of them when this dispute originates. I have prepared, and I ask you to allow me to present this to you. I have prepared a chart that quotes your synopsis that is of record. These are facts that are of some consequence to us in this appeal, I believe. And is the synopsis, where I believe is incorrect or is incomplete on material issues of on material facts, I have cited to the record here in this in the right-hand corner to correct that. So I would like to, if you, with your permission, distribute this to you, file them with the clerk, give them to Mr. Kemp.
Have you shown Mr. Kemp a copy?
No, I just made it up.
Why don't you give it to the clerk and we'll address whether we're going to view that or not. Let's proceed with the argument. I don't think the court is using the synopsis as a basis for its preparation for the case today. We're relying on the briefs. The synopsis is generated by the clerk's office for the purpose of communicating to the public what the general subject matter of the case is about. We rely on the briefs and the record, so why don't you argue the case from that?
I will argue the case from that. In views, I may comment on what I believe to be the inaccuracy of the synopsis, which I treat as something that's before the court.
It isn't, but
yes,
it is not. At least these justices are relying upon the briefs and the record, not the synopsis prepared by the clerk's office.
I'd like to discuss the record and the briefs that were derived of that record with you for the next 10 minutes.
Great.
And then I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
So, we were here in June, before June. We decided, the court decided, another panel. You were on that panel, Justice Cherry.
Yes.
You decided that there were two issues that had to go back to the district court for consideration. You didn't say that there was an issue of fact that has to be resolved by a jury trial. You said there were two issues that had to go back to the court for further proceedings. I have that over here, and those two issues are this. Was there an oral agreement entered into between David Atwell and Richard Alter, under which Richard Alter agreed to, according to the testimony, agreed to pay Richard Atwell the difference between the contract commission he had negotiated with the seller of the Alexis Park, which was 3/4% and the 2% that he had asked for from the seller, but the seller declined. That is the issue with respect to an oral contract. The other issue you sent back for further proceedings in the district court were two equitable claims. One, quantum merit, and two, implied contract in fact, or unjust enrichment. You, in a footnote to or older in 2009, instructed the district court to hold further proceedings on the claims of wanton merit and unjust enrichment. And in point of fact, those proceedings occurred. And the district court made these decisions and supported by these findings that are uncontested. They have not been appealed and they were not quarreled with at the time they were entered. With respect to the claim for unjust enrichment that you directed the court to consider, the court did that. The court examined the same evidence that the jury heard, that the parties and their attorneys presented in court, and he concluded that there was not a claim for unjust enrichment because, citing relevant precedents from this court, there was no money received by the appellant Richard Alter that was intended for Atwell, whether that be the difference between 0.75% and 2% that Atwell wanted from the seller as a commission on the sale of the Alexis Park, or some other number. There was nothing paid to Alter as a consequence of the sale of the Alexis Park Hotel that was intended for or due to Richard or David Atwell. So, the court decided in its conclusion of law number 6, that's at page 1328 of the joint appendix, that there is no claim for unjust enrichment. Now the court went on to consider the other claim that it was directed to consider, and looking at the same evidence that it did to conclude that unjust enrichment was not present here and could not be supported, he said this with respect to quantum merit. Keeping in mind, as your order pointed out in June of 2009, that quantum merit is based on an oral promise, and he found no oral promise. In point of fact, the district judge said this: there was no evidence that any defendant promised plaintiff $2 million or any portion of $2 million that was paid as a consequence of the sale of Alexis Park to the appellant or an associate of the appellant, Richard Alter. Now, the judge also pointed out, which reflects what Atwell testified to. Atwell testified that I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything with respect to rendering services for Richard Alter that I was not obligated to do under my contract with the seller, and the information that I missent and was not directed to Mr. Alter, but went to a dead-end telephone number in New York City, that information I would have provided to Mr. Alter because I was representing the seller, and the seller wanted me to provide information for the sale of this property. You ought to get a commission out of it. So, the court said, and this is remains uncontested, that the services that he performed for Alter were services that he was rendering to at the behest of his client of Hotels Nevada, which was the owner of Alexis Park. Mm-hmm. And the court held, as you instructed it to do, that Atwell must look to the seller for the recovery of his commission. That is his conclusion of law number 8, that is at 1328 of the joint appendix. Now, what does this mean to us? We moved before trial. We moved for summary judgment based on the proposition that what you said in Chum versus Resort Properties several years ago, she was true here. After discovery had closed, after the parties had been deposed, we did not have a claim, a legal claim for a contract between Richard Alter and, Richard Alter and David Abrell. We did not have the contractual elements to support a claim for a contract. The district judge denied that motion. Having been once reversed, he just said denied. And we went on then. We went to trial. We presented through live testimony and exhibits that had already been established through deposition and discovery practice. We presented the same evidence to the court and the jury that we had presented to Judge Barker on motions for summary judgment to persuade him, or in an effort to persuade him, that there was no contract here. There wasn't any legal contract. But it was written, or oral, it didn't exist.
Right? Mr. Morris, your time is getting away from you at this point, but you had a request for a new trial, after the trial.
Yes.
And also you made referencing damages, if any, weren't supported by the evidence. Would you speak to that issue?
Yes, I do. We made more than one post-trial motion. We asked for a new trial. We asked for judgment, J-N-O-V. And the judge denied those without remark. Just denied them. Our principal point here is, I hope I'm responding to your question, the verdict here is not supported by the evidence. In point of fact, the verdict is against the evidence of the proponent, David Atwell, who says, I had a contract with Richard Alter to pay me the difference between 0.75% and 2% that I wanted as my commission for selling this property to Mr. Alter's company. He was not the subject of this contract, but that's what he said. Now, here's what David Abbott, this is not my contention, and it's not our argument on appeal from conflicting facts. The question was there a contract? You said in Smith versus Leprion, you said in many cases that whether the contract is oral or written, it has to be premised on an ascertainable promise. So here's what Atwell had to say about that promise which we say is missing here. You said in your order of reversal earlier that for him to recover a commission, he had to establish an employment contract. And you also said that if he were trying to do that under an equitable theory, that it would be very easy to imply a promise. But here's what Mr. Alter said, or Mr. Atwell said, with respect to the employment contract. I was not employed by Alter. I've never worked as an employee. That's Joint Appendix 1677. I had no agreement with Alter. That's at Joint Appendix 1659. Alter told Atwell, and Atwell acknowledged this, that in November, this is prior to Alter commencing negotiations with Hotels Nevada, through Nevada, through Louis Habash, in January of 2004, Alter sent a letter to Atwell, and it said, you do not represent us. We have no compensation obligation to you. That's at Joint Appendix 1660. With respect to making up the difference between the 0.75% and the 2% that was the subject of this trial, Alder's position was, I made no such agreement, and there was no discussion of such an agreement. Atwell testified that the difference between, recovery of the difference between 0.75% and 2% was not testified, was not discussed with or promised by Alder. It's based on, he said, his feeling, my subjective belief that he ought to make up the difference between 0.75% and 2% because I thought I was entitled to it. But I didn't discuss it with him, and this is important with respect to that theory, I never disclosed to him that I had such an agreement. So there isn't an evidentiary basis to conclude, expressly or by implication, that Richard Alder agreed to make up the difference between what Atwell sought under his contract and what the seller agreed to. It doesn't exist.
Okay, Mr. Morris, I think your time has expired on this argument at this point. I have one question. Did you challenge the jury instructions that were given on the subject of the terms or elements of an oral contract?
I don't recall that we challenged that instruction. We certainly got the instruction is directed to contractual elements. And what we asked for and what was turned down, in fact, Mr. Kemp asked for it too, but it was turned down. We asked for a special verdict. We know we're dealing with legal and equitable claims here, and the judge declined it.
Yeah, I saw that discussion. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kemp.
May it please the court, Kemp Jones and Corfield. Justice Hardesty, I'd like to start out with your question, which was the jury instruction. And the jury instruction, the key instruction is jury instruction number 12. Mm-hmm. That was their instruction. They proposed the instruction. Not only was there no challenge to the instruction, it was their instruction. Basically, we thought the evidence in the case came in fairly well for us, so we agreed to all of their instructions on the oral contract. So what we have here is we have no dispute regarding the jury instructions, including the jury instructions on oral contract. We have no dispute on the admissibility of any evidence. They haven't argued that. So we have a narrow appeal. The only real issue, and Mr. Morris called it the principal point, is whether or not the verdict on the oral agreement was supported by evidence. Okay, turning to the jury instruction, their jury instruction. The key part of the jury instruction is that the mutual consent arises out of the words and acts of the parties. And so I'd like to take a look, and then later on it says conduct and circumstances. So I'd like to start with the conduct and circumstances before focusing on Mr. Atwell's testimony about the 2% agreement. Okay, the conduct and circumstances. First, Mr. Atwell entered into an agreement with the owner of the hotel on February 18th, 2003. That was the letter agreement. In that agreement, he identified Mr. Alder by name, Financial Capital, Mr. Alder's company by name, and any affiliates as potential buyers for the hotel. After he did that, again, that's February 18, 2003, he sent two letters to Mr. Alder on March 1st and on March 6th. March 1st is the one that they dispute getting because of the allegation that it went to New York as opposed to Los Angeles, the 212 versus 213. March 6th letter, they do not dispute not getting that. In the March 6th letter, Mr. Atwell made three key observations. One, he said that the seller was highly motivated. Two, he told Alter that the property could probably be purchased for $75 million, which was less than the asking price. $75 million was ultimately what the property was sold for. So he called that one right on the head. And the third thing is he recommended that Alter explore converting the property into a gaming property. As you know, Alexis Park has never been a gaming property. And he gave them the name of Mr. Fess at Lyle, Sawyer, and Collins, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, to pursue that. So what happens next? And again, this is the conduct and circumstances. Alter calls the game attorney, he calls Mr. Fess, then he comes to Las Vegas, and Mr. Alter and Mr. Atwell go and they view the Alexis Park property. This is sometime in March 2004. At that time, Alter says to Atwell, and these are not disputed facts, he says, please put this on hold, I want to go chase the Aladdin deal. Aladdin was being sold at the time. So Mr. Alter's secretary sends Atwell a confidentiality agreement for the Aladdin deal, which Mr. Atwell, you know it's hard when they're both Alter and Atwell, Mr. Atwell executes. And then in pursuit of the Aladdin deal, Mr. Atwell sends a fax to Alter proposing a meeting with two gaming attorneys, Mr. Wardman and Mr. Powers. Mr. Goldman, the person who owns the cannery right now. All three of them, meet with Alter in Los Angeles, Mr. Atwell, Polis, and when they fly to Los Angeles, they have a meeting there, and Alter tells Atwell, hey, I need a financial partner if I'm going to chase the Aladdin deal, because that's a little more than I thought. So they start working together on a draft proposal that they sent to Mr. Siegel. Siegel is with Westgate Resorts. He was the one who built the property behind the Aladdin, ultimately. So they sent a proposal to Siegel. Then Atwell sends him a letter suggesting, you know, if you're going to look at the Aladdin, you might as well look at the other two that are available at this time, which is the Hilton and Tuscany. And Alter confirms that he asked Atwell to set up a meeting on the Tuscany. So Alter's secretary again sends biographical information of Alter to Atwell so he can present it to the Hilton deal. Alter comes to Vegas yet again, meets with Atwell, and they talk about the Hilton purchase. And after that, Atwell sends the on-the-comb email that we cite. This is on July 31st, 2003. Okay, now remember, Mr. Morris is talking about something that happened in November 2003. Let's talk about what happened in July before that. Atwell sends this email saying, quote, I have been working for you on the come, unquote. Okay. What does Alter do in response to that? 2 weeks later, he sends another letter to Mr. Atwell directing him to invite another potential investor to a meeting in Las Vegas. This is right after the at the come. After that, Atwell sends more information regarding the Tuscany Hotel to Alter. Alter comes to Las Vegas and meets with Mr. Hughes and Mr. Atwell to explore the Tuscany deal. Again, this is all conduct and circumstances that occurred. And then before escrow closed on the Alexis Park deal, and that deal closed, I think, sometime in May 2004, Atwell sends Alter a letter reminding him of the commission obligation. Doesn't get paid. That's the conduct and circumstances. So basically,
well, what do you make, though, of the testimony of your client? I think it's at 8 Joint Appendix 1658. Atwell was asked what was meant by being taken care of in the context of the Alexis Park Hotel transaction. And Atwell testifies, quote, they never even got there, close quote. You have offered a description of the communications and the relationships of the parties, but I pose this question in the context of damages. I am struggling with understanding how the jury could arrive at a damage figure in this case, given that testimony, and there's some other appendix sites that I can refer to as well. Why should this court affirm that verdict?
The issue here is whether there was evidence that supported the 2% agreement. That is the issue, and I think that's the question you're asking me. The evidence, we cited one section in our brief. There were also two other sections. The brief testimony was, quote, but a 2% number was understood, unquote. I'm not going to repeat that because that's cited in the brief three times. In addition to that testimony, this is on Joint Appendix 1640-227. This is on cross-examination. that you never reached that point with Richard on any of these properties where you discussed an actual number, did you? I think that's close to what you're asking, Justice Hardesty. Answer. As I said, at some point in time, we discussed a two-point fee being standard in the industry, fair enough, depending on the work done and the items involved. That's the second piece of testimony. The first one would be the second one. Third one, again, this is on cross. So your testimony is at some point you and Richard discussed 2%. Answer, at some point, yeah. So we have three pieces of testimony where the 2% is referred to. The fourth piece of testimony, and this is on redirect, and this is JA1708. The other two I read were at JA1640 and 1641. Volume A, JA1640 and 1641 were the second two. And like I said, the first one's on 1638. That's the end of the brief. So we have 1, 2, 3. The fourth one, question. Okay, and you told Mr. Garner, quote, the promise to pay you was specific to any deal that had happened that was consummated, unquote. Do you recall that? Correct? Yeah. Answer, does that include Alexis Park? Answer, absolutely. That's at JA1708. We submit that those four pieces of testimony read against the conduct and circumstances, particularly the email that was sent saying, I'm working for you on the come, is sufficient to support the oral promise.
Mr. Kemp, what about the fifth piece in terms of Atwell's testimony as to the difference between the 2% and the 0.75 at 1652 and 53.
Okay, well remember, first of all, we gave a credit for what the buyer ultimately paid, the seller ultimately paid Atwell $200,000. Did not pay him the whole 0.75%, which I think is $525,000. So we gave them a credit for that amount.
It's, you know, he felt it up. Ultimately would take care of him by making the difference. That's
basically what we felt, but that doesn't go to the oral agreement, Your Honor. That does not.
Which is questionable if we.
There's specific testimony on the oral agreement. I don't want to get. Well, maybe I should get into it. Okay, we've gone through the conduct of circumstances. Now, focusing on Mr. Morris's argument. His argument that after all of this had occurred in November of 2003, at the time point that Mr. Alter had secretly gone back to the Alexis Park deal without telling Atwell, at that point he sends this email saying, you don't work for us, we're not going to pay you anything. I would submit that is actually evidence that there was an agreement, because why did that come up all of a sudden? Atwell didn't know that they had gone back to the Alexis Park deal. He sent that email to cover the eventuality that there would be a commission claim. What happened is after they said on the come, after that email was sent on July 31st, 2003, then Alter directs him to do further work on these other projects. But it's only when the Alexis Park deal comes, when he circles back to it, that's when he sends the email saying, you're not working for us. It's not after the very first meetings with the parties. Directing my attention to the argument that the district court determination on the equitable claim has some sort of impact on the legal claim that was resolved by the jury. First, it was a different focus. The equitable claim was based upon the $2 million, which was referred to as a kickback. I don't want to refer to that as a kickback here. Basically, at the close of the escrow, $2 million was wired to some broker in Georgia named Jerry, who immediately didn't do anything on the transaction, and then it was wired back to Mr. Alter. Okay, so we claimed that we should be entitled to that as unjust enrichment. And in their brief on page 2, they conceded that the $2 million was a different claim, and quoting them, the alleged theft was the basis of Atwell's equitable claims for unjust enrichment and quantum merit. The focus of the oral contract claim was $1.5 million, 2% of the sales price. It wasn't on the unjust enrichment claim. So the fact that the district court judge, and this was the conclusion, there was no evidence that any defendant promised plaintiff $2 million or any portion of the $2 million payment to Cherry Investment, and that's true because Atwell didn't know about that particular transaction. So their argument, I think, there are two different things here. The second problem I have with this argument that the district court's equitable determination somehow affects the jury's legal determination is the timing. The jury verdict came out on January 6th, I believe, 2011. This conclusion by the district court was made February 2nd, 2011. So it's not a case like a WADA where we have a district court making a determination on an equitable issue that voids a potential legal issue. It's a case where we have a legal issue that's determined by the jury, and then they're arguing that an equitable determination impacts that was made subsequent to the legal determination. I think that would be a violation of the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial to allow that to happen. So that's my argument on that. Let me check my notes one second. Unless there's any further questions, I think I've covered the points I wanted to cover.
All right, thank you. Mr. Morris, I'll give you 2 minutes.
The question you asked, Justice Douglas, is of some significance. We addressed that on page 16 of our opening brief, where we took a look at what Alger said about being taken care of. And he said in response to that, we never even, with respect to compensation, we never even got there. We didn't discuss it. And we discussed that in the context of the proposition that mutual consent must be freely given and communicated by each party to a contract. Mr. Kent just told you, if you're opening this argument, that you have to determine mutual consent by the words and the conduct of the parties. Well, we certainly have Mr. Hunter's conduct and Mr. Adler's conduct in his words, but we don't have, in the plural, the words and conduct of the parties that come together to allow this court, or the jury for that matter, to determine, which was a subject of one of the instructions, whether there was mutual consent or not.
Well, reading the transcript of the Atwell testimony, it appears to me that it is conflicting, to be kind, at various places. But why shouldn't this court accept the jury's evaluation of him as a witness and his testimony as identified or argued by Mr. Kemp a few minutes ago, dealing with the specificity of the 2% commission? I mean, I recognize that there is conflicting statements by the witness on this point, but at the end of the day, the jury appears to have accepted Atwell's testimony describing this percentage.
But that goes, I submit to you, that would go to the equitable claims he made, which were submitted to the judge, and well, decided against them.
Which got to one of the reasons I had hoped we would have a little argument on this subject is whether or not the test in Shell Oil versus Ed Hoppe Realty is an appropriate test for assessing the damage awards in oral contracts. That case seems to conflate the subject matter of the elements of oral contract with the measure of damages and base it on quantum merit or an equitable calculation. And I think that conflates the contract provisions for an oral agreement. Do you have any observations about that?
Well, it may conflate oral and express agreements, or equitable agreements. But what we don't have here, Your Honor, what we don't have, whether we're considering legal or equitable, and the judge has decided the equitable claims, we don't have evidence from the parties with respect to the, I know we have Mr. Atwell testifying inconsistently from time to time, but we don't have any testimony from Richard Alter that joins any portion of his conflicting testimony so that we can conclude, as you have said in other cases, that mutual consent must be manifested either in words or by the conduct of the parties, not one person, the parties. We're here dealing with just the legal claim here, the oral contract claim. And I point out, as we have in our brief, that we don't have, in point of fact, we disavowed any contract or any obligation to Mr. Atwell. We did that in writing. And I also point out that the argument that Mr. Kemp has made and cites his brief and sections of the record in support of that, that Alter and Atwell got together in Los Angeles or exchanged some correspondence, well, not exchanged, but Atwell sent Alter some correspondence on March the 6th. That was addressed under the rubric of the equitable claims. And the district court held on this evidence that whatever services Atwell was claiming to have provided for the benefit of Alter were services that he was obligated to render and in fact were rendered at the behest of his client, the seller of the Alexis Park Hotel, Hotels Nevada. This is not something that Alter invited or concurred in. In point of fact, and this comes back to your question about this measure of damage differential.
I think we have your point, Mr. Morris. You're out of time. Thank you.